Sneak out for a second to make one last second change to my slide, and hopefully it made it into the version I gave to Jim. If not, we'll just use our imaginations later. But these are kind of fun Sundays to teach, because Jeff's done the heavy lifting of analyzing a book of the Bible, and now we just kind of get to take shots with it. We get to sort of take shots, or maybe a better way to say it is help with the payoff. And that's what I hope happens today. We've heard a lot about worldview as Jeff has been teaching through Romans. And so what today I want to do is I want us to actually focus on worldview, what it is, what yours is, and then what does it mean for that worldview to actually be impacted by the gospel? So that's what we're doing today. And it's largely driven from Romans 12, 1 and 2, which is way more than just a really good verse or couple of verses. You know, if there ever were verses that are given more meaning by where they're located in the Bible, there may not be any more than this, because this is the transition point. Paul in his letter has had three sections where he's been laying some basic teaching, and now he's going to shift into what does that actually look like for us. And he does that with Romans 12, 1 and 2. Those are the pivotal verses that tie the whole book together. And that has the famous phrase, you know, be transformed by the renewing of your minds. That's his summary of what all of his teaching is supposed to do to you. And not just you, but all of us. So that's what we're going to look at today. I may be the only one, but do you feel a bit overwhelmed sometimes by Jeff's teaching? Some of you can relate to me. I mean, it's pretty incredible sometimes. And there's always a lot of stuff. And sometimes the real payoff, I think, we don't see it, even though it's right in front of us. One of the things Jeff has done as he looked at every section in Romans was he gave us a one-paragraph summary of the teaching. I don't know if you know that he did that, because he gave us a lot of other stuff. But there's one slide every week that says this is a one-paragraph summary. If you don't feel like you've really walked away from Jeff's teaching on Romans with the core stuff you should have, go back and find each of those four. And if you want to know it in a little bit more detail, every week he gives us this list of six or seven things that one paragraph summary really means. And pay close attention to those, because there's just so much richness in it. I find that one paragraph per section, though, is still a little bit long sometimes. And I find it's hard to just sort of give you that paragraph. So what I've done is I've actually reduced it to four phrases. That's the book of Romans, I think. So you got the first four chapters. It's all about God's covenant faithfulness as the context for everything. The second part is really the part that focuses on changing worldview. If God's covenant faithfulness, particularly as it relates to the unique work of Jesus, and if you believe in him, well, then it's supposed to affect your worldview. Well, that's what 6 through 8 was about. 9 through 11 is a lot of different conversations related to the nation of Israel and how the fact that there's a future for Israel shows that God's plan is continuing. It isn't just a whole new thing. It's a continuation of his plan. And then lastly, transformation comes through renewal in God's household. That's my attempt to just make it really short. And if you want to make it even shorter than that, just remember, covenant faithfulness, worldview, Israel, and renewal. Right there in five words, you got the book of Romans. Thank you. We'll see you next week. I don't know, I find when I do that, then when I go back into the paragraph, I understand the paragraph better, I understand the 7 points better. And sometimes if you can't do it in these few words, sometimes the paragraph and all the other points don't actually even make sense. But hopefully this helps you a little bit, and if you were trying to just tell someone what's in the book of Romans, I think it's easier to go off of just a couple of key words. Little memory trick that got me some really good scores on essay exams in college. It's just memorize real simple outlines that trigger the right stuff and make sure you use the right buzzwords. All right, that's just kind of an overview of it. And that's kind of getting us where we want to go. Or giving us a starting point. The other starting point I want to have for us today is to think in terms of what is a worldview. I did a little bit of research. I got a couple of different definitions. Okay, it's the way someone thinks about the world. Worldview. View world. Okay. Maybe too simple to be all that helpful, but maybe, you know, it really is that simple sometimes. Next one is a little more detailed, a comprehensive conception or apprehension of the world, especially from a specific standpoint. All right, that's getting at it a little bit more. And then the next one sort of helps you to think of what that specific standpoint might be. Politics, philosophy, religion. Here's the way I tried to sort of give you my basic definition of worldview. Worldview is the lenses through which you see and understand things. Not just the thing that you see, but that gives meaning to what you see. And it's the ways that you think, and it's the perspectives that guide you, some of which you may not even be aware of. Those are the most powerful ones. That everyone around you can see it, but you can't see it sometimes. But if it's still the way you think, then those are really important. And notice I did it plural. You know, I think worldview is not a single thing. I think worldview is almost always a combination of some pretty fundamental ways of looking at things and understanding things. So we're going to examine that some this morning. So what is your worldview? As Jeff went through Romans, he talked several times about the various worldview options that they had there in the first century for the early church. Had the Roman, Greek, and then a Hebraic, which was really, I don't even think, a true Hebraic. It was more of a twisting of the Hebraic that the Pharisees controlled. I always call that false Judaism, not true Judaism. But there were some worldviews. There were very few practitioners of real Judaism. If they had, they would have believed in Jesus instead of crucifying him. So how many of you would say you have the Roman, Greek, or Hebraic worldviews? All right, so like I predicted, those are not necessarily all that helpful for us. Now, some of us who have had the opportunity to go to seminary and do some other things, we think about this question a lot, and we try to force modern culture into these categories, and we try to analyze you. How Greek are you? How Hebraic are you? There's books from Jerusalem to Athens, which is this great concept of how the Christianity moved from being sort of a Jewish thing to being a European thing, and it's a great academic intramurals, I call it. But practically speaking, most of us don't think in those terms. That's not a particularly helpful way for us to think about worldview. So, how can we? I want you to do a little exercise in a few minutes where I want you to make a list of words. Not words that describe you, but the words that people who know you would use to describe you, or if I ask some people who knew you, like, how do they see things? What are the lenses they look through to see things? what would they say those lenses are? And what I want you to try to do is make it a give a list of maybe just five words. No more than five words if you can. And preferably not phrases or sentences. So I really want you to hone in on core ideas. Don't worry about putting them any kind of a rank order of this one is a more important lens than the other. Don't worry about that for right now. And if you need a little help doing this, these are some of the things you may want to think about. They may be related to your heritage, your family, your nationality, your ethnicity. It may have to do with where you live. It may have to do with your vocation or your interests. Maybe something age, gender, or family, or some of those specific standpoints that were mentioned before. All right, so take about 2 minutes, and if you've got something to take notes on or a phone, five words. If you need to use more than five, oh, okay. But it'll ruin the exercise. Just drop in on that table and ask somebody from that table to give us their words.
Christian, wife and mother, musician, nurse, American.
All right. I think that was seven words, but all right. Tim, walk around. Let people grab you. Don't wait for them. If you see a table, you just hand it to the table. That always works pretty well. Good. Joel, grab it. You're the closest there.
Well, I only came up with two so far. But old-fashioned and conservative.
Old-fashioned and conservative. So that's really four words to describe kind of one thing. Oh, okay.
Okay, I got some.
Okay.
Cards fan, son, Christian. Ultra-conservative.
All right, what was the first one?
Cards fan.
Cards fan. There we go. That took a nasty twist. As a Cubs fan. Apparently we're going to have some world view clash here. A couple more.
Biblical, and then optimistic based on God is in control.
So two, biblical and optimistic with an explanation. All right. Not realistic, you're optimistic. It helps in our relationship that you're optimistic, not realistic. Go ahead, give it any of those. Just drop it in, Tim. When he's done texting, he can give us.
I have, Christian is one of mine, intellectual is another one, which is both good and, or bad, depending on who's aiming that word at me. So.
Those are two, huh? All right. Cranky, okay. I don't know. Now we're getting someplace. Yeah. Again, what would people around you say? There we go. Oh, Aaron's going to have a stroke if you don't give it to him before too long. He's yearning for it.
So you have to hear the last part of this word and the fact that the first part is not, the first letter is not capitalized, okay?
Long explanation.
Right.
Probably
well,
makes
you only
it
get
worse.
One word, so you got to string it out somehow, right?
Yeah.
So the word is democratic.
All right. Thank you, Brock. All right, let me put mine up there. I put five up. And again, I didn't think about this very long. I said, what do people who know me think about me? Including people who, like, are in other parts of the world. All right. White male. Pretty core to who I am. An American. Although it is interesting to be in other parts of the world and they kind of ask you, where are you from? I think, I'm from America. Isn't that obvious? No. Could be Britain. Could be all sorts of other white places. So for them, it's that's not necessarily an assumption. So white male, American, Christian, Cyclone. Like I say, not in rank order. Now, what do those things mean? And here's where I cheat a little bit, and I load those with meaning, because they, white could mean white supremacist. Let me make a little clarification here. When I refer to white, I'm really not so much referring to skin color as much as I am being part of a majority culture in a culture that is majority composed of white people. I'm a non-specific white person. I don't know where I came from. It's like I'm not one of your Norwegian-y guys or whatever. I don't know where I came from in all that. And I haven't done any of the genetic testing yet to figure that out, although I think that would be really interesting to do. So that's kind of who I am in terms of white. And again, it's one of those things that, like, did anybody else put white on their list? A few? And I'll bet it's because you've been hanging around Chinese lately. I mean, that probably has an impact on it. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I did an around-the-world trip, and everywhere I went, I was very aware that I was white and nobody else was, or very few were. And especially when you're in Nigeria, places like that, it's like, wow, I am white. And everyone in this room, that's the first thing they think about me. That's the white guy. You ask anybody in the room, who's the white guy? They all point at me. I mean, it's not just my worldview, it's their worldview of how they see me. But most of us aren't aware of that. You get really aware of it when you get out of a place where you're in the majority context. If you're not white, you're more likely to list it. If you're in a majority culture, you're more likely to list it as that you're aware of your worldview. Majority, you're not necessarily. You're usually a lot less aware of it. And by the way, if you ask any of your black friends to describe your worldview, they will probably say white. You might not, but they probably would. Male. All right, what do I mean by that? It's not just a little baby male, but an adult, husband, father, son, brother, a lot of different aspects of that. Not a wife beater. Which in some parts of the world, being a male adult husband father means you get to beat up on your family. In many parts of the world, that's what that means. Well, okay, that's not what it means for me. American. And when I say American, I'm not so much being patriotic as much as I am trying to capture some other aspects of worldview that might be better described as Western. I think about things from a Western point of view. I do have a political thing, although I'm less and less of a Republican. I'm trying to figure out what a Republican is anymore. Chicagoan. Take the boy out of Chicago, but you can't take the Chicago out of the boy. I have embraced Ames. I'm educated. And if you ask just about anybody else in the world, what does it mean to be an American, they're going to usually say, affluent. They're going to think of you as privileged. You may not think of yourself as privileged, but the poorest among us is pretty privileged compared to most of the world. And that's the way we view our world, whether we think about it that way or not. Christian listed a lot of different characteristics there. Evangelical. Postmodern, some combination of that, trying to figure out what comes after evangelical that has the good parts of evangelical and is better aligned with the way of Christ and his apostles. That's kind of what I'm getting at with Antioch there and some other things related to that. My cyclone. That does focus mostly on athletics. I'm not a huge fan of cyclone engineering. I don't even know what that is. If there is such a thing, there's Iowa State engineering. Is there cyclone engineering? Tune into Mel. Really? All right. I'm also a Panther. Being a cyclone is not mutually exclusive with being a UNI fan. Go Panthers. Thanks for wearing the colors today. It is mutually exclusive with the team out east. As you know me, you know that's what I mean when I'm a cyclone. Captures several of those things. Doesn't necessarily. My daughter wears these pansy shirts that have all three Regent schools on them, and can't we all get along? No, we can't. I don't know where she got that worldview. All right, that's my worldview. So just kind of gives you a little way of just thinking it through. I think if you talk to a broad spectrum of people who would say, how do I look at things, even people in other parts of the world tend to know I'm a cyclone. Now, let's do a little something else with it. How do some parts shape other parts? For instance, if I were putting these in sort of priority order grammatically, am I a white male American Christian cyclone? Is this mostly describing what type of cyclone I am? Well, no, I don't think that is. Maybe on a few Saturdays in the fall it might, but generally this isn't just trying. There isn't one, or the cyclone part doesn't trump the others. Am I an American white male Christian or cyclone Christian? Is this describing the type of Christian that I am? Right, that may make a little more sense to you. Or am I a Christian white male American who happens to like the cyclones? Couple of comments on that. The second one is moving toward it because it's paying very much, very good attention to my context. But my Christianity needs to take a form in my context, but is it really shaped by it? What trumps what? Is there anything about being a white male American cyclone that overrules my being a Christian? Shouldn't. But is there anything about me being a Christian that might trump me being a white male American cyclone? Yeah. So actually, I'd say the third one is really the way to think about this sort of thing, and that my participation in whatever context I'm in is shaped by my Christianity. Now, that's a little bit of a dance going on there, because sometimes it's hard to figure out what your Christianity really is without some interplay in context. But ultimately, it's about how to be a Christian in whatever context you're in. I don't have to give up being a white male American cyclone to be a Christian, but there are aspects of those other things that I need to control because I am a Christian. Does that make any sense? All right, now let's get to some more work on our worldview. Is your worldview being transformed by the renewing of your mind as a Christian? It's one thing to say you're all of those things, but all right, now, are you really a Christian version of those things? And how do you know? Let me give you a few ways that you can help know, and then I want you to be discussing your worldview in light of some of these things. And actually, you guys can hand this out while I'm talking about it a little bit, because this is the next set of slides are on here. for those of you that are taking shots and trying to write them down, the next bit you don't have to worry about. It's on the handout. But it starts with just going back to Romans 12, 1 and 2. Is this an important passage to you? It's the transitional passage in Romans. For some of us, it's a verse or a couple of verses that we've memorized. But is it important? Is this actually describing the way we should be approaching our faith? Because we can believe everything that was in Romans 1 through 11, but if we don't make the transition to 12, then so what? And in my experience, a lot of my theological education has been all about systematically understanding Romans 1 through 11 and then breezing through 12 to 16, not taking 12 to 16 very seriously. Well, I think this verse is just crucial for us to say, do I even care? I'm a Christian. Whatever, you know, my heart has been made new. I got my ticket to heaven. Got my hell insurance. I don't think much about being renewed. I don't think much about the ongoing impact of the gospel in my life. Well, then you're pretty much blowing off what Paul taught here. So it starts, I think, with taking this really seriously, treating this like it is a pivotal passage. I think it also means keeping the whole book of Romans in mind. Not just Romans, but certainly keeping the book of Romans in mind. You know, that's going to help you a great deal. And so if you've just kind of gone through these last few weeks with Jeff and you haven't walked away with confident that you can get your hands around the book of Romans, then you need to go back and do that. That's why I put the cookies on the lower shelf right here. Get this. If you find Jeff's slides a little overwhelming sometimes, does this overwhelm you? Put on your big boy pants then at this point. One slide. Just a few phrases that describe each section. At least get that. And then hopefully that'll help you benefit from the other things that Jeff has done as well. But now, if you're looking at this, might there be one of those four areas that you would want to pay special attention to if you're thinking about how to have a transformed worldview? Is there one of those four? Yes, one answer. Which one? Yeah, maybe the one that has the word worldview in it. Maybe that'd be a good one to focus on. And putting the cookies on the lower shelf here. That's what we're going to do for a few minutes. Now, I want to go back to Jeff's teaching and what are the seven things that he said, Romans 5 through 8. What are the seven aspects of how it helps us transform our worldview? So let's look at those. They're on there. And again, I've kind of underlined some key words so that, you know, we can quickly get to things. Focusing on God's covenant promise. I mean, there's a bigger thing going on here. Keep that in mind. Two, it's very much related to Jesus. And this belief in Jesus is now the critical component of aligning ourselves with God's plan. Three, that does give us a new identity, and an identity that is itself aligned with purposes of that covenant or God's plan. It's a whole new way of thinking. It doesn't replace groaning. This was a fascinating one to me, that we still groan. What does that mean? It means we don't have everything yet, and we shouldn't expect everything yet. And if we're really, really content with the way things are, then we probably don't understand God's plan, because he has more in mind. Do we groan sometimes and go, oh, I just wish God just cleaned it all up and just made it all perfect now? Well, he will. But part of this teaching is to help us think in terms of groaning for it, not just expecting God to give us everything now and to have no desire for more of his plan, which is different than our plan. The Spirit has an important role in this. The Spirit comes along and it helps us, particularly in that groaning where we just don't understand. That's one of the places that the Spirit particularly comes alongside us and helps. And then our perspective on this is not that this is just some superstitious thing that may break at any moment. Like, oh, if I forget to go to house church, God's going to judge me, kind of thing. You know, some of us put a lot of pressure on ourselves as if our relationship with God is dependent on the latest little thing that we've done in expression of our Christianity. And no, it's a much deeper thing than that. And just our even our failures don't separate us from that. All right, so those are that's just a rehearsal of Jeff's 7 items. Again, to try to help you, I've put those in just a short list there. You've got that on your sheet, and you're trying to just put it into a few words. So now what I want you to do is I want you to take a good, I don't know, what time is it here? Take a good 15 minutes, and at your tables I want you to talk about your worldview in light of some of those things. How does some of those things challenge your worldview? Are there places where your worldview comes in conflict with what Paul says our worldview ought to be? Don't, and really what I want you to do now is to not defend yourself very much. The more you focus on the places where your worldview is actually challenged by the biblical teaching, the better. If you come out of this exercise just feeling really good about having a biblical worldview and nothing is challenged, then I don't think you've tried very hard. And I don't think you're being honest with yourself. Because the whole idea of Paul writing this was to bring transformation. And if you need a little help, just call me over to your table, and I'll be glad to point out all of your inadequacies and how your worldview may need to be challenged. But all right, take 15 minutes and just discuss with yourselves how this challenges your worldview. Warnings is not primarily for you to finish doing something on Sunday mornings. It's really more of a stimulation of the conversations that you should be having with others, particularly in your house churches on Sunday night. So I don't worry at all about interrupting you and not letting you quite finish, because our intention is not so much to finish as much as just to get things started here on Sunday mornings. So what I thought I would do next is just give you a little bit of a glimpse into my worldview and some of the challenges or some of what it has meant to have my worldview challenged. So, notice how cleverly I changed all the pronouns there. All right. Again, one of the first things is to actually not be content with good enough. I mean, I look around the room this morning, I don't see a lot of mass murderers. I don't see a lot of people that I would say, oh, what an awful pagan. You know, what an awful person. A few. They know who they are. They're chuckling right now. Yeah, well, that too. Which is an evidence of the redemption that's going on in me, is that that's not what I was thinking. I wasn't just thinking of Hawkeye fans there. But now that you mention it, generally, we're pretty content folks. We're pretty good folks. We didn't come here because we were desperate to get fixed this morning. We came here because we're good people who want to get a little better, maybe. We didn't really come here. I don't think very many of us came here because we're just feeling like we are so desperately in need of transformation. Most of us have settled in. We're better than most. Not a pagan, not a mass murderer, unlikely to be one soon. Didn't cheat on my taxes this weekend much. Starting from a posture that says, no, I should assume that there is plenty that still needs to be challenged. So, how did some of these things get challenged? And more specifically, when I look at some of these things, what does it mean for me to allow some of these aspects of my worldview to be challenged? And now I'm gonna take you into about a 50-year experience that is largely related to this. Who is this? It's Jesus, right? I mean, the one on the left, we had that hanging above the fireplace in our house growing up. You know, the one on the right. These are chalk drawings by a Moody Bible Institute evening school student in 1940 named Warner Solomon, who was taking a theology course, and he was an artist, and he wanted to do theology and culture. And so instead of just reading systematic theology about Jesus, he drew a chalk drawing of Jesus. It's the way he viewed Jesus. And consequently, many of us have come to think about Jesus this way. It's the most reproduced image of Jesus ever. It's just a fascinating thing that that's so often the way we think about Jesus. It's interesting how we've taught people in other parts of the world to think about Jesus like this. Now, let's look at him a little more closely. Do you think Jesus had a pointy nose? Probably not. You know, nice cropped beard, flowing locks. You know, really nice clean robe all the time. I mean, there's a lot that's not quite right about this, but this illustrates a tendency that is not a bad tendency. I mean, Warner Solomon wanted to have, I mean, he's an artist. He wanted to have a graphic representation of Jesus. So he did it. It just was informed more by his worldview than biblical teaching. Because if he was paying close attention to biblical teaching, there would have been some physical characteristic differences here in it. But this illustrates a tendency that I think we all have. And you know, Caleb, you and I have talked about this. The tendency for people to create Jesus in their own image. If you want Jesus to be a friend, then you tend to think about Jesus and all the verses about Jesus being your friend or your savior. Or if you're really down on yourself, you probably only think about Jesus as a judge. And all of those things are true, but none of them are true in isolation. That's not Jesus. Jesus is all of those things. And we have to be really careful that, because I think most of us, myself included, not the least of which was growing up looking at this in my house every day, that's Jesus. I'm still working through that a little bit. What do you think about this one on the left? Who's on the left? Who is it on the left? It's Jesus. And to the people who made it, it's not black Jesus, it's Jesus. They were doing the same thing that Warner Solomon did. They were just making a picture of Jesus that they could relate to. This is a Jesus that I can relate to. Most of us would say, well, that's not Jesus. But not very many of us said about the one on the right, that's not Jesus. Neither one are Jesus. Neither one are accurate representations of what he probably physically looked like based on everything that we know. Both of them are just representations of Jesus that help him be relatable to them. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been into an African-American Christian bookstore. Not a lot of those in Ames. A lot of those in Chicago. And you go in there, the whole little kitschy section has black Jesus. I mean, almost everything is black Jesus there. And I don't know what you feel about that. But if that bothers you, but the one on the right doesn't bother you, then you've probably uncovered another issue. If the one on the left is not Jesus, but the one on the right is, then you actually have some issues related to your whiteness that need to be dealt with, because neither one represent Jesus. It's been interesting over time, because that was my first reaction. That's not Jesus. Well, no, neither of them are. But I was quick to make that judgment on the one on the left. I'm less quick to make that judgment now, and I appreciate why they're doing it. And for the most part, it's not Nation of Islam people who are doing it in a way to bring Jesus into their nationalistic, black nationalism warfare. For the most part, it's just African Americans trying to have a relatable image of Jesus for them. I get that, and I'm not judgmental on that. Not judgmental on why Warner Solomon did what he did, or even, you know, is it bad that I had all these great warm feelings looking at those paintings in our house? No, it's not a bad thing, but it's an inadequate thing. And I probably need to come to think about Jesus differently. Neither of these pictures of, or drawings of Jesus really capture who Jesus is in God's plan, because that does have some historical, cultural rooting to it that doesn't come across in these photos. All right, let's come back to a couple of other things. So the male adult husband father thing. It's pretty deeply rooted in culture that older men who are husbands and fathers have a lot of control. They have a lot of influence, and often their families are just their workforces. What Christianity calls for us to do is to make sure, I mean, there's one basic command in Scripture for Christian husbands. What is it? Love your wife. And then what does that look like? Does that mean, oh, give her nice gifts, hug, smooch, smooch, love you, honey? Is that what that means? Well, it includes that. But it describes what it means. It means to help her be holy and blameless. It means to love her the way Christ loves the church, to make it holy and blameless before him. That means as husbands, we have a responsibility for the spiritual care and nurture of our wives. But in our culture, so often, our wives are way ahead of us spiritually. Most of us don't take it all that seriously that as a husband, that's what my love is supposed to look like. We may twist it a little bit and say, well, yeah, that's why I drag her to Sunday morning. Okay, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, is there anything more to it? Well, yeah, I think scriptural teaching challenges us in our position of not just being a hunter and gatherer and provide for my family. They get a house, they get food, they got money in the bank, they got that kind of stuff. But is there any sort of a spiritual inheritance being built? Scripture calls for us to do that. There's plenty more that we could get into here. The American part. I grew up as part of a church that would have God and country Sundays. God and country. And we'd sing the Star Spangled Banner, and we were all patriotic, which was a good thing. I've traveled around the world. I'll take America. Coming back from Jos to Abuja, I probably got stopped 30 times by military checkpoints, and all because they knew I was an American, and what they saw was affluent. So, oh, sir, how's your day? All this kind of, give me something. One guy threatened to detain us if we didn't give him something. I loved my driver. My driver just laughed at him and said, blow your whistle. He said, blow your whistle. He just laughed. But I'm so glad I was with him because I would have caved. And then he would have radioed ahead and everybody else would have done the same thing the whole way. How do you view yourselves? I like being an American. But in my heritage, I got to be a little bit careful because it linked it a little too closely. The patriotism, I mean, they like to talk about America as the new Israel. I think that's a dangerous thing to do. I don't think they've paid a lot of attention to Romans 1 through 9 on, or 1 through 11 on that. It's easy to get that mixed up, and it's easy to be so patriotic that you can't imagine a world in which America isn't a significant player. I mean, look at the role America has played in missions. It's huge. But it's not indispensable. And just sort of seeing this for what it is. And then Jim took advantage of our discussion time to start training me on what it means to have a redeemed cyclone worldview. Literally, from the perspective of a Hawkeye fan who lives in Ames, who went to Iowa State, and who learned what it's like to be in a, what's the right word, an adverse culture. So, I mean, yeah, I probably do have a few things I still need to learn on that, and 90% of what I say is just funny, but there's still a 10% there that probably does need some shaping. Okay, just a little glimpse into what it looks like. Now, but now let's connect some of these things back, particularly with Romans. Do I think about America as just a place that sends missionaries and is continuing God's work? It's obviously an important thing to Paul in his letters. Or do I see America as just one point in the history of what God is doing with the world? Do I see what God is doing as raising up indigenous Christianity in all parts of the world? That's one of the things that I have to do as I travel around, is to help people who are products of missionary culture not think of themselves as missionary churches anymore. To help them think about themselves as indigenous churches and indigenous church movements. That maybe there were some American missionaries who had some influence along the way, praise God for that, but now what? And helping it to take root, and particularly in instances where it's 100 years after the missionaries did that. I mean, I went into, when I was in Jos, Nigeria, one of the things I saw in many different places around their headquarters were these paintings of these three Northern European guys who were the founders of the mission, and they were the first ones that came there to Nigeria from this mission, and they're paintings are everywhere. Like, where's the painting of Yusufu Turaki? Get that thing up there. You know, there are so many really significant leaders within their own movement who weren't up there. It's like the headquarters church had one, it had a cross, and then it had this painting of these three Northern European guys. I think some that rubbed me the wrong way. Now, for them, it was honoring their heritage, honoring the commitment they gave. There's probably some goodness to that, but to me, there was more to it, and there was an overshadowing. And so, you know, we need to be very alert to say, no, all of this is rooted in God's plan. And whatever God has done with America, he may or may not choose to continue to do that. Do we have a view of God, his plan, his purposes, that's big enough for God to do what he wants? Or are we so caught up in our own aspect of worldview and culture that we kind of, we just can't even imagine that? Well, then we probably don't actually understand his plan. Because his plan has gone for thousands of years before there was ever an America. Doesn't make America bad. America's been very great. But it's only one nation in God's world. All right, Tim, you got a microphone? I'd like to hear from a couple of people about things that maybe you had some challenge on. Where did the teaching of Romans actually challenge your worldview? There it is. Walk around, Tim. They're not going to come to you. Anybody have anything to share with us? Go drop the mic at Randy's table if nobody raised their hands. And not with Randy. Randy can give it to somebody else. Randy's worldview is perfectly Christian.
I'm going to admit I didn't listen to anything of what just happened and didn't realize the mic was right there. What was the question?
Just pass the mic. All right. Randy,
can I talk?
Yeah.
In our previous, when we were discussing this, looking at your list of seven on your brief phrases on your slide to add. I zoned in on number five, the one grown in hope of full redemption to come. Mm-hmm. And I just been aware as I've been balding and getting older and all the health stuff, you know, that comes, you know, for, you know, most of you are aware with Carol and all, that I am. I'm much more excited about the blessing aspect of being Christian than I am about this groaning with the view of redemption to come and God making all things right in the end. I mean, I can conceptually be excited, but just the experience of that, you know, I'm much more excited about the blessing side of it. Yeah. And so anyway, I zoned in on that one when I saw
it. And there's so much in Paul's teaching about the actual blessing that's in the groaning, and that, you know, that sometimes you just don't see God when things are going well. You're much more alert to God during the times of groaning, I think. Yeah. In fact, I would even say that groaning sort of fits the experience that I was having in some parts of the world, where it's not just that I'm being critical of what the missionaries did. I'm critical that the missionaries don't let go more. And I just groan. I thought, oh God, why can't you just have these people really focusing on their own culture instead of trying to imitate things that are still outside their culture? Jordan.
So the last question, how do you know? We kind of got to that near the end, but then we ran out of time. But I think the idea of your worldview being transformed by the renewing of your mind means that you're more cognizant of what your worldview is and that there's personal growth going on. So I think maybe that the transformation, as we discuss, is not just a one-time thing, of course. It's a constant renewing and transformation. So, you know, the transformation is recognizing what your worldview is. There's growth going on in your understanding. So you might know it by seeing personal growth and so forth, that you're actually having your mind transformed and renewed.
Yeah. And particularly to sort of come to know what it is compared to some of those around us. Because often you really don't see it until there's some contrast.
So we were talking at the end of the conversation about that question, and it's those friction points. As you're just cruising along, just having a great worldview that's perfect and there's nothing wrong with it until something like the pictures. Why did that one cause a reaction and that one didn't? For me and working through the process of transformation is always looking for those, where'd that come from? Those friction points where life rubs up against my worldview, and then I look at what I would consider my biblical worldview and say, these don't line up. So I'm always looking for friction points.
And most of us don't live in those kind of environments where there's a lot of friction. Most of us have avoided that friction. Most of us don't welcome it. I've got a couple of just practical suggestions for you. How do you know if your worldview is being properly transformed? Well, you care about being mature, holy and blameless before the Lord. You're not just content to be a Christian, but that you really care about where God wants you to go. You don't just assume it's happening, but that you engage in, number three, you engage in some friction points. That you're willing to be examined and challenged. That you want some of those people. Not that 24/7 it's all about people beating you down on what you part of your worldview needs to be improved, but ever? I mean, do you take a couple of hours a year to let it happen? Or more often than that? You welcome assistance from those that God has put into your life to help you develop. Translated, spouses, children, house church members who dare to question my cloniness. You're actually seeing some changes. Can you look back at your life, particularly your recent history, and say, okay, here's some things that were clear teaching of Scripture that I was not obeying, or that I wasn't obeying well, or I hadn't let move into this sector of my life, and now I am? Can you point to anything? If you can't point to anything, you may have found it. And it might not be there. If you can point to it, then you can have at least some confidence that something is going on. And then lastly, taking seriously God's promise, plan, and purposes. And so many of us have us-centered versions of Christianity. Well, is it about us? Or is it about what God is doing? You know, is it about inviting Jesus into your heart so you have a personal Savior? Or is it about yielding to the Creator of the universe who died for the sins of mankind? How dare you do anything else? Well, one has God's promise, plan, and purposes clearly in mind. A lot of us had a more personal relationship with Jesus that probably needs to be more informed by how does that actually fit into what God is doing. And there's a dozen other things that I want to talk about sometime. I talk about how superstitious we tend to be sometimes, or how we kind of dismiss, people have a worldview that says, loving God wouldn't allow that, and then they recreate Christianity the way they think it ought to be, because they can do such a better job than God. Anyway, a lot of those things. Tonight, particularly in our house churches, but not exclusively that. Continue to ask the questions about what is your worldview. And here I've changed it from personal to plural, or from singular to plural, because I think it's not bad for us to think about what our community culture is like as well, and our community worldview. And then, is it being transformed, and how do we know? And again, particularly, it's why I gave you the sheet with the teachings coming out of Romans, so that you can use that as a point of reference. So we will we'll finish with that, and ask God to bless not just this time, but your time tonight. Amen.